The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon, you're on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Just a quick reminder, this Daily Maverick Show is proudly delivered to you by Postnet Courier.
Today, Patty from Parais sent Christmas presents to Paris. Graham from Grahamstown sent gifts to Chomotso and Gaborone. Both used Postnet Global Express. They chose from 8 different box sizes, packed their items in their boxes, and their parcels were delivered directly to their international destinations. Postnet Global Express delivers to-door anywhere worldwide. It's easy, affordable, and convenient. Plus, you can track your parcel online. There are over 300 Postnet stores nationwide. Locate your nearest store at postnet.co.za.
Good afternoon. You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central, just about 1:06 p.m. Quick roundup of what we'll be talking about today. First, we'll be talking to Ranjeni Munusami, our associate editor, who's live at the COSATU Congress, which is going into its second day. Also, we'll be talking to Greg Nicholson about the parliamentary report on violence against foreign nationals. We saw a big outbreak of that earlier in the year, and we want to hear what our parliamentarians are finding about what's going on there. And lastly, we'll be speaking to Simon Allison about a lot of news issues around the continent. We saw the attacks in Mali late last week, as well as what's looking like a resurgence of Ebola in Liberia, which we thought had been declared Ebola-free. So a really packed show lined up. Let's get into it. Greg Nicholson, the man who brings the heat even after the heat wave. Welcome okay. to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Man, I want to go straight to Ranjeni. I think she's been holding on the line. Ranjeni, can you hear us? All right, not quite. Greg, tell me about what you've been working on with the Parliamentary Commission. What were the findings? Earlier this year, we saw the big, you know, flaring of xenophobic violence, or what later was called xenophobic violence, in Gauteng, in KZN. What's the report about? What did they find?
Yeah, well, obviously, as we all know, there are a few flare-ups of xenophobic violence this year. In sort of late January, early February, I think it was, we saw instances in Soweto, particularly in Snake Park, and then that sort of spread to other areas where we saw a couple of deaths, particularly related to challenges, I guess, in these townships between foreign nationals, the ones generally who own stores, and some of the community residents. And then, of course, we saw it flare up again in around April, where it started in and around Durban and some of the townships in KZN. And from there, that was actually quite intense. Right? I think it was up to 9,000 people or something. 9,000 foreigners had to flee into camps. And from there, sort of it spread and sort of continued. And then it came to Joburg, came back to Joburg, I guess. And we saw all these different instances in Jeppe. So this is just a quick wrap, so you remember what's going on. And everybody knows about the killing that was on featured quite graphically on the front cover of the Sunday Times of Emmanuel Sotolo or Emmanuel Joseas. And that really spurred the government to action. That's how we saw the army in the townships through Operation Fiala. We saw a big response. And one of the longer-term responses that we saw from the state was the launch of this ad hoc joint committee in Parliament probing the violence against foreign nationals. So what this committee's been doing for the last, I think it was launched in May and maybe started its work around June. What it's been doing is visiting some of the key sites where this violence over the year has occurred, speaking to some of the key role players, looking into some of the real specific allegations, deciding whether this thing was xenophobic, and looking into some of the root causes of these problems.
I mean, I'm curious that you use the word root cause. I mean, there's so many underlying factors. There's so much background. So I'm curious, did the report center on things like, you know, the looting that happened to some of the shops and the reaction we saw to that, and said, listen, this actually started from these isolated incidents? Or was it more, you know, more of a sort of, I don't want to say social science approach, but to look into the asylum seekers coming to the country, the refugees, the lack of economic opportunities? What approach would you say it took?
So it sort of jumped around between the two different approaches, really. And so it did look in parts about South Africa's pull and push factors that result in migrants coming to South Africa, and the issues of instability within other African countries in particular. And so from about sort of midway through the sort of Central African countries down, sort of pushing migrants down, and then the pull factors of having, you know, a strong economy, greater political stability than many of the neighboring countries. And so sort of combined those issues with some of the problems around particularly, I guess, township economies. And so on the one hand, there were some really general root causes that's, you know, it's sort of, you just sort of scratch your head when you think about how we're going to solve this thing, like jobs, right? So there's, everybody knows we have a job crisis in South Africa with you know, the official unemployment rate at a little bit over 25%, I think, still. And then we also have a housing, you know, there's housing shortages, there's all these sort of things. So the foreigners come in, you know, and they're often in these sort of low income earning areas with South Africans, and then South Africans can get annoyed, or something can spark them, and then it sort of builds resentment, as well as there aren't specific social integration programs. Despite, and this is one of the sort of the shocking things too, is that despite the 2008 xenophobic violence, which really did spread, and was quite horrific. While we didn't see that sort of violence this time, and the report commends the state and civil society actors for preventing the expansion of that to those levels this year, it does note that there haven't been any significant social integration programs since 2008, which is quite shocking.
I mean, that's weird that you can simultaneously pat yourself on the back and say, hey, it didn't get as bad as 2008. And then in the next line say, granted, we really didn't do anything since 2008.
That's one of, I think, the key struggles of this report, because at times it feels like it does respond to political criticisms and does try to sort of pat people on the back, which I think I think it is fair for them to say, listen, we haven't done enough for some of the long-term changes that we needed to make, but at least our short-term crisis intervention.
Oh, the crisis management, the second you hear that something has happened.
That's right. But I don't think it was as good as it could have been still this year, personally. But so, yeah, back to the causes of this thing. And so the report finds that, you know, there's these just sort of living amongst each other in what's a very resource-challenged areas creates tensions, you know, amongst foreigners and locals. And so that's sort of the thing as to, you know, like, what's the solution? Grow the economy, create jobs, you know, build more houses. Sure, but that's, you know, that's no short-term solution, particularly with the economy, how it's going. Then there are these other more specific root causes that the report identifies. And it's, so they come back to some things like township businesses, particularly on the, like, spaza shops and things like that, where there's actually some quite interesting statistics where it identified specific areas. So Jeppe, for example, Jeppe's town in Johannesburg, where I think was quite a high percentage of that area around where there were protests. The register stores there, a very high percentage of them are foreign owned.
Okay.
So there's some things like that. And so they looked into some of the causes as to why are foreigners better at business. And there have been other studies on, or in certain areas, there have been other studies done on these things. You know, that has been one of the key issues, excuse me, that's come up since the xenophobic violence this year. But then again, it's, so we already know that, right? That there are locals who are annoyed because foreigners are owning a lot of spaza shops.
That's part of my worry. They come back and be like, guys, we've established that there's some tension in communities, and spaza shops are somewhat involved in the tension.
That's right.
And it's like, okay.
And so the only really recommendation on these sort of things is, you know, the Ministry of Small Business should support, offer, because these local businesses generally have locally owned businesses, it says, have very little support or no support at all. And so the Ministry of Small Business should offer some sort of greater incentives and things like that. But otherwise, on that front, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to sort of calculate what can be done, at least from this report's recommendations.
Yeah.
And the alternative, it's easy for the report to condemn foreigners, right? So even when the report is describing how, so foreigners living in South Africa, for example, perhaps they have better business skills because I'm not sure they're more entrepreneurial where they come from or something like that, or they're more desperate, I'm not sure. But they also have greater networks and can, you know, buy goods wholesale and issues like that. So, but then the report, sometimes when it mentions these things, the tone seems to be quite accusatory. And it also says that some shops, you know, like salons and spaza shops, are in fact fronts for drug trades and brothels. And, you know,
and that's only the ones owned by foreigners, I'm assuming.
Well, that's one of the things, right? And then also the issue of, you know, undocumented foreigners and the large amount of foreigners that have come into South Africa that it's been hard to control and provide accurate information on So that looks at that problem, but it's, you know, it's after reading the reports and looking at the solutions, I was left a little bit underwhelmed. It did help me understand a little bit more, because of course this team have been able to go to some of the key points on this issue. They have been collecting submissions, but I would have liked to see much stronger recommendations, particularly incorporating some of the recommendations from the many civil society actors that did make submissions to this group.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, but I suppose perhaps you were expecting too much. We did a lot of analysis as this thing played out, and perhaps this is just the official one that takes a while, but perhaps it may feel disappointing because a lot of these things were discussed.
But you know. It's also disappointing because these things have also been discussed after the 2008 attacks. And we have to remember that while we mark 2008 and 2015 as particular, I guess, waves of xenophobia, which the report says it wasn't xenophobia, particular waves of violence against foreign nationals. We have to remember that throughout this period, there have been attacks on foreign nationals. And the key thing is, if this report, or if there aren't significant and comprehensive interventions made now, it seems obvious that the pattern will simply continue.
Well, there you have it. The Ad Hoc Joint Committee Probing Violence Against Foreign Nationals. That's their report. Greg,
catchy name, man. Update.
I know, right? It's, you know, we should get an acronym. The AHJCOB. Oh, never mind. Anyway, if you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Remember, you can tweet us on @DMShowZA. Next, we'll be talking to Ranjeni Munusami, who I think can finally hear us on the line. Ranjeni, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, perfect. I'm sorry for the mix-up about that.
Yes, it's quite noisy here, as you can imagine. There are about 3,000 people in one room, and every single one has a smartphone, so it's not surprising that that the network takes strain.
Okay, I mean, let's get into it. You're at the COSATU Congress. It's the second day. Could you give us some context, just coming into day one? I mean, what were you expecting? Was there this disunity and some of the sort of fracturing we've seen from COSATU? What, coming into the Congress, what were you expecting?
Okay, so you must remember that pretty much the same group of people were in the same room just in July this year for a special national congress. That congress was called to deal precisely with the problems in society, the divisions, the issues affecting Zwelinzima Mavavi and NUMSA. But this one is a scheduled national congress. It's called every 3 years to renew the leadership of COSATU and also to deal with issues generally affecting the working class and how COSATU interacts with the ANC and the SACP, the alliance partners. So what happened yesterday was, it was expected to be pretty smooth running because, now that NUMSA is no longer here and the union's affiliates that were loyal to them, made a big show of things at the Special National Congress in July. So they were expected, to just go with the flow here. But that didn't really happen. You had a Food and Allied Workers Union, which is one of the smaller unions here at this Congress. They only have 160 delegates out of 2,500 voting delegates. They were quite rebellious here, taking on the COSATU leadership on the issue of credentials first and foremost. They were questioning the inclusion of the new metal workers union, LIMUSA, and also the status of COSATU's second deputy president, Zingli Sawadzorsi, because they believe she's illegitimate. So that was the first thing they did. And they held up the Congress for most of yesterday. It was quite bizarre that President Zuma came to address this Congress, but he was kept in a holding room downstairs and couldn't come in for a couple of hours and then left to attend an ANC meeting and then came back last night to address the Congress. So when he returned last night, there was another fight going on, and that was about the nomination for the top six positions in COSATU. Mm. So what he had is five of those six positions. The people were nominated, the same leadership were nominated uncontested. But we've had a vacancy for the position of General Secretary. The former Deputy General Secretary, Begin Salim Sali, was nominated unopposed. But FAU then put up a last-minute stand to say they want to reopen the nominations for all those positions. So that was another fight last night.
Wow.
But today, things are quite smooth running. It's just a presentation of the political report and a debate on that. And you also had an address by the SACP General Secretary, Lady Zimande.
Wow, sounds like a rocky day yesterday. Ranjani, I'm curious. I've been quite confused by what the president was attempting to say in his speech. Could you clarify for us some of the remarks and what some of the intent behind what he was trying to explain in his speech yesterday?
Unfortunately, if I attempt to do that, I'd need some special skill in the art of mind reading, because he puzzled quite a lot of people with what he was saying. Firstly, there was an attack on capitalism, and he was saying that the capitalist class basically dictates society. Mm. They do things like set bread prices and oil prices, which is quite strange, because then you have an international organization called OPEC, which does precisely that. also when it comes to things like bread pricing, there is regulation of that through things like the Competition Commission, and government does have jurisdiction over that. So once again, you had President Zuma, acting quite helpless in front of these delegates. Now, you must know that, there has been some turmoil in COSATU about whether they are being adequately represented politically. Mm-hmm. So it was up to President Zuma to give them some reassurance that the ANC still represents their interests. Mm-hmm. However, the president then, he was saying that the ANC has never intended to fight for socialism, which, was a strange message to present to an organization that unashamedly advocates for socialism in their lifetime. Mm. Many of the workers here are also members of the SACP. So I don't know if the president was not aware of who he was addressing or came here to make that point. Yeah. I don't know. It was quite strange.
Mm. Ranjani, how's the feeling? Obviously, this Congress, COSATU's come into it with such, it's been fractured, it's split. How is the focus and attention on unity there? I'd imagine it's talked about a lot, but it seems that the sort of fracture that we've seen in the past is now just the status quo?
Well, yes, unity is a central message being advocated. It was a central theme of the President Zuma Dlamini's message, opening speech here yesterday, as well as President Zuma's message, the strong emphasis on unity. However, the bizarre thing is that as soon as the president stopped speaking and left the podium, the fight, over the top six position started once again. So, while they preach unity, it's very difficult in a group of people like this who have diverse interests. Many of them are unhappy with the state of the alliance, the state of the country, the loss of workers in the country. Although that is always a theme of SACP, ANC, COSATU Congresses, it's very difficult to, in reality, achieve a situation where everybody's marching in tune and have the same perspectives on issues.
Now, also, Ranjani, one of the issues, I guess, that we've already mentioned that sort of overshadows the Congress is the expulsion of the Metal Workers Union and General Secretary as well, Nzima Vavi. Have they been mentioned? Are people sort of worried about their potential forming of a new federation?
Nothing whatsoever. Many people assume that they would still be looming over this Congress. Mm. They're not really. There's some mention of them and their intentions to form a new federation. There's some mention of that in the organizational report and political report, but it hasn't really come up in conversation other than just in passing, even in the President Zuma Dlamini speech. I think that era of NUMSA and Vavi are now well and truly behind COSATU, especially now that they announced that they're not going to appeal their expulsion at this Congress. So, no, it's not really an issue. But obviously, the forces that were loyal to them, unions such as SACAWU, FAWU, they're still quite rebellious here. And of course, there's a suspicion that the reason for that is that they have an agenda that was set by NUMSA, which they are carrying out here. That that they want to still continue to split COSATU, and that is why FAU and SACAWU are putting up a fight on almost everything here. But it's difficult to say that because FAU, for example, has not been attending NUMSA's meetings that they have called on things like the United Front, on their meetings on forming a new federation. So it's really not clear what exactly is FAU's intentions and whether they will, in fact, at some stage, try to leave COSATU.
Ranjani, I'm curious about sort of the political sort of future of how, the fracturing we're seeing in the tripartite alliance could play out. Do you see this affecting municipal elections next year, or just wider than that? What do you see as the sort of ramifications on the country of a significantly weakened or continuing to weaken tripartite alliance?
Okay, so they're clearly unhappy with the state of the alliance, and they feel that the ANC doesn't take COSATU and SACP positions seriously, that they don't sit on key committees where the ANC makes big decisions. So they feel quite neglected, but it's a typical, battered wife syndrome where they can't really do much to ratchet up the pressure on the ANC to take them more seriously. They can keep screaming about it here, and in fact, some delegates in the discussion were saying that they need to stop being crybabies and need to find other ways to influence, to assert their influence on the alliance. But it's easier said than done because, the ANC is so dominant, it still enjoys a majority. So although the ANC does need COSATU and the SACP on the campaign trail, they can continue to treat them as junior partners in the alliance and get away with it. So I don't know what exactly this Congress can come up with to make sure that the ANC takes them more seriously. Other than the militant language and strong calls on the ANC to listen to them on issues such as the National Development Plan, where they have serious concerns on issues on the economy and on labor, other issues like labor brokers. I doubt there's going to be significant changes in government policy. But for their part, COSATU, from what the language I'm hearing and from what I'm reading in the documents, they still pledge unequivocal support for the ANC in next year's local government election.
Now, Ranjani, one of the issues leading up to this Congress was the fact that with NUMSA pulling out, it sort of pulled key revenues from COSATU's budget, and COSATU has had two national congresses in quick succession. People were worried about can they pay for the event, and how does it look there? Are there enough water bottles and banners?
Oh yeah, I mean it's a full Congress with all the trimming, but one thing that was quite comical earlier was that after the address by the SACP General Secretary Bladen Zimande, and a song burst out on communism, and people were marching around singing. But as that was happening, the banners of the sponsors were being flashed on the big screen. That was quite funny to watch. But so, yes, there are always those contradictions at events like this. COSATU is admitting that it does have financial problems. The concerns about the investment arms of various unions, about Kopana Kamatla, the investment arm of COSATU and how it's managed, and there's an intention to close that down. So there are serious financial problems, but apparently the sponsors came to the party, and that's why they're able to have T-shirts and water bottles and so forth. On the issue of succession, the COSATU leadership is being quite careful to say that it's not COSATU's business to pronounce now at this stage who they want as President Jacob Zuma's successor and who they want in the leadership of the ANC in 2017. However, some unions are trying to defy that line. In the discussion just now on the political report, a delegate from SATU, in fact, sneaked it in, saying that we must be careful to and make sure that the deputy president of the ANC is elected as the ANC president in 2017.
Wow.
And there was a loud applause from the entire Congress for that. So clearly, COSATU is going to rally behind Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, but they're just careful as to when they do it and that they don't offend the ANC in the way they do it.
And Jenny, I hope you got some of those T-shirts for the rest of us. Thanks for the roundup.
You look quite good in red, so I'll try to do my best to get one for you.
Okay, perfect. We'll let you get back to it. Thanks so much.
Okay, perfect.
As mentioned, that's Associate Editor for the Daily Maverick, Ranjeni Munusamy, who's live at the COSATU Congress and giving us everything going on from there. We're just going to go into a quick break and then come back and talk all things continental with Simon Allison. Remember, this Daily Maverick show is proudly delivered to you by Postnet Courier.
Dora from Delmas sent documents to Dana in Dallas. Tandiwe sent toys from Tabazimbi to Toronto. Both used Postnet Global Express. They chose from 8 different box sizes, packed their items in their boxes, and their parcels were delivered directly to their international destinations. Postnet Global Express delivers to-door anywhere worldwide. It's easy, affordable, and convenient. Plus, you can track your parcel online. There are over 300 Postnet stores nationwide. Locate your nearest store at postnet.co.za.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Remember, you can join the conversation on at DMShowZA. We love to hear from you. Solomon, thank you for the tweets. We love engaging with you every week. We're just about to go through to Simon Allison to talk about some of the news from around the continent. Simon, can you hear us?
I'm with you, Kingsley.
Okay, perfect. Simon, firstly, it's good to have you on. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I'm sorry I couldn't be with you in the studio today.
No, I'm sure you're busy elsewhere. Now, next, Simon, I'm curious if you could give us an update on what's going on in Mali. We saw the attacks late last week that really rocked the continent and shocked us, you know, down here. And I'm just curious what's been happening since.
Well, look, I want to start with a bit of context on this Mali stuff. I was in Bamako about 2 months ago.
Mm.
And what was astonishing to me is how active the conflict is in Mali, but how little we know about it.
Mm.
And I think a big part of that is the sort of divide between the English bits of Africa, the sort of colonial English bits of Africa, and the colonial French bits of Africa. Because there was plenty of French media. There's plenty of coverage in the big French publications, the big French African publications, but there really hasn't been anything in the Anglophone media. And that's why this attack has really caught us so much by surprise, because we kind of thought, yeah, we know Mali had problems, had a bit of a civil war, but they had an election, they sorted it out, it's all fine there now. It's not all fine there now. It really is still an active conflict zone. In the north, which is where the rebellion started in, I think it was 2012, 2013. In the north, it really is still an area that the government has almost no control over, certainly that the UN peacekeeping force has no control over, which means it is a place where various political groups, some of them Islamists, some of them nationalists, some of them separatists, they can use that area to really, you know, have their base, to regroup, to prepare. And one of these groups, the group called themselves the Maribitun, they have now claimed credit for this attack on Bamako. And it really is no surprise, because it's the government in Bamako, it's the UN force that is headquartered in Bamako that they are fighting against.
Now, Simon, was this an attempt, do you think, to derail the peace process that's underway within Mali?
You know, we talk a lot about peace processes in this line of work. You know, South Sudan signed a historic peace conference, a peace process, what, 2 or 3 months ago, and look where they are. They're already fighting again. So, yes, there was a peace agreement signed between most of the rebel groups in, I think it was June or July. But that agreement was always very tenuous, and it wasn't signed by all of the fighting parties. So I think that, you know, when we were talking, you know, people talking about peace in Mali are already missing the point, because peace doesn't come from an agreement. It really is only going to come when some of the structural issues that really drive this conflict are sorted out. One of the major ones, of course, is, you know, economic inequality between the north and the south. Another is historic marginalization, which is harder to address. And then a third one is that Mali cannot be looked at in isolation. Mali can only be seen as one part of the puzzle, with Algeria being another part, Libya being another part, Niger being another part. You know, the whole Sahel region is trying to deal with a threat from various rebel groups, many of whom have taken up the sort of Islamist flag. And I think that we have to deal with it as a regional problem rather than a country-specific problem. And we have seen signs that this is happening. The French have launched an operation. It's called Operation Barkhane, I think. And that is headquartered in, I want to say, Niger. And it sort of looks at five different countries to get that regional perspective and recognize that, you know, because you can bomb someone in Mali, for example, but all they have to do is hop across the border into Algeria, and then they're safe all of a sudden. And that really is what needs to happen if we're going to stop these groups once and for all.
So, I mean, that seems to be one of the key things, that this hotel was, I think it's sort of a lot of foreigners staying there, and the French have been sort of leading this regional fight against these groups through Operation Barkhane. Is this sort of a fight back to that French force that sort of tries to strike them back at their hearts while they've been sort of pushing all of these militants out?
Look, I think if you're a militant group looking for a target in a city like Bamako, and Bamako is like many other African cities where it doesn't have a huge amount of infrastructure that caters to the rich and to the elite. You know, it doesn't have that many fancy restaurants or five-star hotels. So where do you want to, as a militant, where do you want to cause the damage? You know, do you want to bomb the market, which is, you know, poor people that aren't making decisions, or do you want to bomb high-value targets? Mm. Now, the answer is not always the same. You know, Boko Haram, for example, are renowned for bombing marketplaces, for bombing bus stops, for bombing ordinary people. But certainly in Mali, we haven't seen too much of that. We tend to see groups go for, you know, they really are targeting what they perceive as their enemies. And a hotel like the Radisson Blu brings together a number of those enemies. It brings together the French. It brings together UN peacekeepers who are sipping coffee there on their duty breaks. It brings together all the government officials who go there and they spend their, you know, their per diems that they earned in some conference. They spend that in the hotel restaurant. So it really, you know, it the Radisson Blu and hotels of that ilk sort of bring all those high-value targets together into one place. And it just is a very sensible place for a militant group to attack. So it's a bit too early to say that this is directed just against the French, although that certainly would have played a role. But I think rather it's better to look at it as sort of it's a one, you know, the Radisson Blu is a one-stop shop where the militants can go for all their enemies once.
I hear you, Simon. That's something we'll continue to watch. Just quickly to change topics, could you tell us a bit about the child marriages? That's something that the continent is focusing on this week. This is not really something that we see in the headlines too much. Could you just give us some context?
You know, we do not see this in the headlines at all. And I've been talking to people about this, South Africans, saying, oh, you know, I went to Mozambique and we met some child brides and the AU is having a big thing on child marriage and everybody being like, what? Is there, you know, do we have child marriages in Southern Africa? Mm. You know, everyone said, I thought that was like Afghanistan or Yemen or something. Surely it's not in Mozambique, which is right next door.
Mm.
The truth is quite shocking, actually. So I went to Mozambique to a province a little bit north of Maputo in Nyambane, and Mozambique has one of the highest rates of child marriage in the world. So almost one out of every two women in Mozambique was married before the age of 18, which is really a shocking statistic. If you know, if I think about how completely immature I am in my own life and unable to make serious decisions, and I'm 29, to think of having to make these kinds of life-changing decisions at 13, 14, 15 years old, and of course, often these girls have no choice in the matter. So what is happening is in Lusaka, on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the African Union is meeting for the first ever summit to end child marriage in Africa. And it's really a big deal because, you know, this clearly is an issue. I mean, Africa accounts for 13% of all the child marriage in the world. So it's a big issue on the continent. It's something we need to tackle. But there hasn't really been a political spotlight on it before. And so the AU is hoping to put that political spotlight on. And then what it needs to do is kind of twofold. Number one, it needs to make sure there are legal restrictions against child marriage. At the moment, in many countries, there are legal loopholes that say, well, you know, if there's consent of the parents, often not consent of the child. With consent of the parents, the child can get married, or sometimes it's not criminalized at all. So the first push will just be make sure that all countries' laws criminalize child marriage. The second push, and this is so much harder, is to start changing cultural perception about what child marriage is. So one social worker in Mozambique, she said to me, look, we have this legal definition of what a child is, age 18, and then the person is no longer a child. But if you are in a village where age is not a very important thing, how do you define what's a child and what's not? And often the definition is physical. So once a girl grows breasts and has her period, then she is considered to be an adult. And changing this idea to be like, no, you know, because actually, even though she shows signs of being a woman, outward signs, she really isn't ready to bear children yet, especially, and make kind of big life decisions. So that's really what has to change.
Simon, this is a bit of a dumb question, but on this issue, can you just take us back in terms of the key negative effects of child marriage? I'd imagine that it reduces, it takes some girls out of school, it sort of forces them into a life situation that they're not ready to make that decision for. It perhaps makes them more prone to, I guess, getting pregnant and then even HIV/AIDS or something like that at a very young age. But when we talk about these issues, what impact does it have on these young girls' lives?
Absolutely. It's a really good question. And you did raise some of the main effects there. The big one is education. Almost none of these girls who get married early continue with their education. A second one is it has kind of pretty severe health problems. You know, especially with women who aren't ready to engage in any kind of sexual relations, are sort of forced to have it at a young age before they are ready. And this can cause very, very serious complications for the body. It can really, you know, create hardships for life. It also, you know, more generally, has a very important effect on gender relations. So what happens almost always is now you get these young, uneducated girls who have to stay at home and look after kids at a young age. And then it's men who continue with education, and it's men who go out and get jobs. So what that means is you are sort of reinforcing the dynamic in society of men being educated breadwinners and women being uneducated stay-at-home parents. And it really makes it very difficult to address gender inequality in that context.
And I'm glad that you brought up the gender inequality. I think the last time you were on the show, we talked about the AU's at least verbal commitment to this issue of gender inequality and you know, and how that has been sometimes lacking. Do you think this and the fact that this summit exists is a big win or a clear sign that the AU is actually serious about this issue?
It is a big sign. I think it's a big step. And I think our very own Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma deserves quite a lot of credit for pushing this through, because I really don't think that this would have happened. Well, indeed, it didn't happen under any of her predecessors' tenures as AU chair. And, of course, she is the first female AU chair we've had. And it's an example of the kind of small, incremental stuff that the AU does well. Sure, they can't solve South Sudan or Somalia, but these are huge issues that, you know, frankly, no one can solve. But the AU does a really good job at these little issues. So, you know, and it's a slow process, but calling this meeting, getting all the relevant ministers, as well as many first ladies, and, of course, in many countries where democracy doesn't happen so much, the first lady can be more influential than any government official. So it's important to get the first ladies involved too. So it's all these influential people talking to them about child marriages, explaining why it's bad, explaining what needs to change and what can be done, and then them hopefully going home, changing their own legislation, and starting to change some of the norms. This is how change happens. It happens gradually, it happens slowly, but you've got to start somewhere, and the AU is making that start. And I think it deserves a lot of credit for that.
I mean, I hear you. Here we are talking about it right now, right? So, you know, clearly it's done something. Simon, I'd like to change topics quickly and ask about the resurgence of Ebola in Liberia. I mean, that's something that really, really surprised me. And I just wanted to get your opinion on that. Is this, you know, how did this happen?
It's complicated. I know quite a few people who work with Doctors Without Borders, either in Liberia now or who have come back, and they're all devastated because, you know, they all thought that this disease had been eliminated. And, of course, that was what was announced a few months ago. But, of course, that area, you know, Sierra Leone, Guinea, Liberia, the borders are very porous. It's easy for people to come and go across those borders. So, you know, as long as one of those countries remains infected, and at the moment Guinea is infected, there's always a risk that the disease can jump back across the border with somebody. However, what's interesting about this Liberia case and what is really, really worrying the medical authorities who are examining it is they can't find an obvious link. So, you know, the first victim they picked up, they found him in Monrovia, the capital city. Him or her, I'm not sure who it was, but they found the person in the capital. They've also found three or four people that are also infected, but they cannot trace the link from those people to existing infections in Guinea.
That's crazy.
So they don't really know how it got across the border. You know, and what they're asking themselves now is there, are there cases of Ebola that we have missed? And we haven't actually got rid of the disease in the first place at all. So that's a really big worry at the moment. But having said that, the procedures now are so well established. Everyone knows what they're doing. They know how to react to these Ebola cases. They know how to trace the contacts, and they've started doing that. It is highly, highly unlikely that we'll see any outbreak, any small outbreak, develop into a massive outbreak of the kind of stuff we were seeing last year.
I mean, yeah, that was my worry. I mean, you mentioned the porous borders, and I'm thinking the second, if we have a resurgence in one country, does it create, you know, a massive scare? But it sounds like that given the levels of containment, that's unlikely, right?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we will continue seeing cases of Ebola here and there, you know, two or three there, three or four there. But ultimately, we're not going to see hundreds and hundreds of cases at the same time. Unless the virus starts mutating and changing the way that it infects people, and that's the big worry, is that if it, you know, becomes airborne rather than only passed on by bodily fluids, then we could be in serious trouble. But there's no sign of that happening now, so we probably shouldn't worry about it too much.
Okay. So it's quite interesting now that, so as this crisis phase of Ebola, I guess, is sort of wrapping up, and we've had an opportunity to reflect on the response to it. We've seen in the last couple of days the World Health Organization take some pretty harsh criticism over their response or their lack or late response.
It's not new, but it, you know, there is this one new report that has laid into the World Health Organization, but it is the latest of several reports that have done the same. Doctors Without Borders, you know, in the initial stage of the outbreak, was scathing in its criticism of the WHO's slow response. So, yes, the WHO messed up badly on Ebola. It missed the warning signals. It missed the chance to nip the epidemic in the bud. It didn't raise the alarm, which is really what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to see these things before anyone else, and it's supposed to find a way to fix it. And it failed. But it has also admitted that it failed. You know, it has said, look, we did some things wrong. We did lots of things wrong when it comes to Ebola. And hopefully they have learned those lessons. They say they've learned those lessons. But we're only going to know until we see another epidemic come up.
I hear you, Simon. I think we were ready to bash the WHO a bit, but it sounds like you're painting them as being reflective and honest about what happened and how to, you know, do better next time. So it's really hard to fault that.
I'd like to believe that of everyone, Kingsley. I'm just an optimistic guy.
Very sweet of you. Simon, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you for coming. I hope you're in studio next time.
Always a pleasure.
Okay,
thanks,
perfect. Thanks. That's Senior Africa Correspondent of the Daily Maverick, Simon Allison. Greg, we've just got a few minutes left. I've been dying to just say this on air, man.
South African movie
won an Emmy this morning. I'm just so excited.
Mine is shot down.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. No, it's been a big year for South African movies, and mine is shot down, I guess. I saw the announcement that it's won an Emmy, and I'm going to look into it a little bit later on this afternoon. But I think it's fantastic. It was people have their different opinions on the documentary. It's a documentary by, I think, director Rihad Desai, who's very active in the Marikana support campaign. I think this movie came out about a year, I think, after the massacre in August 2012. And it's a very... it's hard to even describe. Very emotional portrayal of those Absolutely. Events in the week, I think, leading up to those killings in Marikana. And so it's fantastic that it's finally been recognized. I'm not sure of the process why it took so long to be recognized to win an Emmy. But one of the key things that will define the South Africa's response to it is the access people have to it. We have a South African Emmy award-winning documentary that hasn't, and it doesn't look like there are any plans to air it on free-to-air television, which, of course, is how most people in the country watch TV.
I mean, that was actually my second thought. First was, you know, giant excitement. The second was, I wonder what this does to its chances of being seen by majority of the country. I mean, is it even realistic to expect that this will ever be on television?
It's hard to know. We don't know what's in the minds of the executives at E! and the SABC, content procurement sort of guys. But I know there was talk.
You can assume there's not much going on at SABC right now. They're just trying to keep their jobs.
Well, interestingly, there was. I remember, so I did a story on this a year or so ago about, because Rihad Desai was pushing for it to be on these stations. Yep. And I can't remember which station it was, but there was talk about... Excuse me. There was talk about at least either E! Or one of the SABC TV stations about sort of having the go-ahead for it, but then it didn't seem to materialize. So I think it certainly adds a lot of weight to the calls to have it aired on free-to-air TV, that's for sure.
I mean, it's... The thing is, and then part of my excitement, I suppose, pushing for this movie to be seen. It's, I mean, it's less really... And the movie ultimately is just a vehicle to honor and to talk about, you know, the lives that were lost at Marikana and that continued sort of pursuit for justice. I mean, there's been some conversations about the compensation. Mm. I think that only happened about, 2 hours ago, and the whole, I think the DA and Musi Maimane are launching some kind of, compensation plan.
Yeah.
Is that something you've had a chance to look at?
No, not yet. I haven't had a chance to look at that, but I think it happened later on this morning, and it's probably a follow-up of the Democratic Alliance's proposals to introduce a bill to compensate the victims and the relatives of the victims from Marikana. But on the airing of Mine is Shot Down, I think, I'm not sure if honouring those who were killed and those involved is a great motivation. Of course, it's important to do that, but the problem is this: the Marikana massacre is so political, and the thing is that I think the key argument that everyone should be able to appreciate in terms of having miners shot down on public free television is information. So we need different stories and different opinions on this issue, and it's crucial, this event, for South Africa's post-apartheid democracy and history and politics, and we need all the information out there as possible. And if we have a documentary that is very well done, it's received a lot of awards, and it can really help inform the public and add to all the other information that we also know and can discuss about Marikana, then I think that's just going to help us deal with this post-apartheid, this really crucial post-apartheid event, and I think the country needs to deal with it, and we need all the information possible to deal with it.
Absolutely. There you heard it. For anyone listening, please, you can go on YouTube, just search Miners Shot Down. It's been made available to watch for free, just, I suppose, in celebration of this moment and its success. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. The Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Remember, you can download and share the podcast from cliffcentral.com. We'll see you next week, same time, 1 to 2 p.m. See you then.
Dora from Delmas sent documents to Dana in Dallas. Tandiwe sent toys from Tabazimbi to Toronto. Both used PostNet Global Express. They chose from 8 different box sizes, packed their items in their boxes, and their parcels were delivered directly to their international destinations. Postnet Global Express delivers two-door anywhere worldwide. It's easy, affordable, and convenient. Plus, you can track your parcel online. There are over 300 Postnet stores nationwide. Locate your nearest store at postnet.co.za.
Thanks for tuning in. Remember, this Daily Maverick show is proudly delivered to you by Postnet Courier.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.